This is a HeadGum Original.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
How did you hear about the podcast?
Somebody like sent me a link to it. I think you'd had 3 episodes posted by the time I found it. And so then I just caught up with it and then started listening to it. You know, I'm a fan.
I was planning on reaching out to Ron Livingston at some point, but I never got the chance. He beat me to it.
You don't really very often get to hear like an entertaining podcast that also happens to be about, you know, a big event in your own life. I kind of felt like I'm the demograph for it.
Ron, of course, played Captain Lewis Nixon in Band of Brothers. If I had met him back in the year 2000, I imagine I probably would have been a little bit nervous. I wouldn't have known him from Office Space at the time. That film had not yet fully achieved its status as a cult classic. But I had definitely seen him in the movie Swingers.
And it's about like being an actor and like all the shit you have to go through. And I mean, it seemed crazy that I wouldn't offer to talk to you about it.
I thought this was a very good omen. A second chance to connect with someone I almost worked with 20 years ago. And I wanted to make the most of it. But what exactly would that look like? What would be the best use of this opportunity? My first conversation with an actor I nearly shared a scene with in HBO's Band of Brothers. Do you have any like traumatic either audition or casting or acting experiences?
Oh, yeah.
Stick with you?
Yeah, definitely. Although I got to preface it, nobody I know has one like yours. Yours is, I think, perhaps the worst one that I've ever heard of. I don't think there's any that are worse than that. I mean, I've been on a show, and then the next thing I knew, I wasn't on the show anymore, but I still got to do the show for a while. I had stuff that I auditioned for and really wanted and didn't get. You know, and some of those broke my heart.
This is Dead Eyes, a podcast about one actor's quest to find out why Tom Hanks fired him from a small role in the 2001 HBO miniseries Band of Brothers.
I'm Connor Ratliff. I'm an actor and comedian. 20 years ago, I was fired by Tom Hanks.
They told you they had it. Then they told you you had to re-audition for it. And then they said you're not the guy. And not only that, they just did such a sloppy job with the communication that, like, they told you you had dead eyes.
And that's the short version.
Like, that's terrible, Connor. That's like, I mean, yeah, that's terrible.
One of the most important elements of being an actor is working with other actors. There are obviously exceptions to this. If you're a monologist doing one-person shows or in instances where the technology of modern filmmaking allows for people to capture all the elements of a performance in isolation. But for the most part, acting is about the connection between human beings, relating to each other. If you're doing it right, your performance doesn't exist as a separate, unchangeable entity. You pay attention to what the other actors in a scene are doing, and you allow yourself to be affected by it. All of which is just a long-winded way of saying acting is reacting. On a personal level, meeting other actors you're going to be working with is both exciting and nerve-wracking. There's a social element. In addition to doing scenes together, you're going to maybe all break for lunch at the same time. Do you sit with them? Do you sit by yourself? It can feel a little bit like high school. Does everybody else already know each other? Or are they that confident around people they just met? When Ron Livingston reached out to me, I wasn't nervous about it. I had a good feeling based on his email that this was going to be an easy breezy conversation. And I was was in luck because Ron turned out to be just about as kind and empathetic as I could have hoped for. If I'd gotten into like a Stanley Kubrick movie and then got uncast from that because I had dead eyes, it would make sense in a different way. I would think, well, he's this intense, you know, kind of intimidating figure.
Oh, so Stanley Kubrick doesn't like me. Fine. You know, okay, whatever. He's got it. Yeah. No, Tom Hanks, it's like, yeah, it's America's sweetheart. You're screwed, you know? It's like when you break up with somebody and you divvy up the friends. There's no way you're going to get any of the friends. Tom's
Zero.
Getting all the friends,
Zero.
You know?
Yeah.
And I had, you know, I had a relationship with Tom Hanks because not only because I was a huge fan of his, but I had sort of been ripping him off in the sitcom world for a couple of years. Like when I first started out, I didn't quite get what sitcoms were supposed to be and how it was. The only time it finally started to click was when I just started ripping off Tom Hanks, and then all of a sudden it was like, oh, okay, that's a thing, and they might need one who's, you know, they need a younger one, so let's just try to do that. So I was very self-conscious about it.
Now, when you say ripping him off, do you mean like timing things or like cadence?
Timing things, and like doing his bits and like, you know... Oh, come on. Yeah. You know, just all the little Tom Hanks-isms. And I didn't know, you know, I was like, well, I can't do those in the audition. But it wasn't, it was a different guy, so it wasn't really a problem.
Did you have a rapport with him? Like, what was the vibe like?
I did. He's, you know, as you've said, he's kind of the nicest guy in the world, and it's kind of authentic. And he works really hard to try to make everybody around him feel comfortable and not like starstruck and crazy. You know, I was kind of a little starstruck and crazy anyway. But I had a good relationship because I get a little funny when I work, and it's like all about, you know, I get a little methody and whatever. So it's like I didn't have a problem going to him if I needed something for the character, you know what I mean? Or for the scene.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't going to go out for a drink with him afterwards, although he, you know, he might have invited me and I just would have been like, but yeah, that's just like a really weird thing. It's, I don't think I ever quite got over that.
Have you interacted with him since Band of Brothers?
Yeah, I've seen him off and on and off now and then. A lot of it was the Band of Brothers publicity. There's stuff. There's times I've seen him, but it's like we don't do game night together.
Do you have any memories of that day of shooting that scene?
Oh, absolutely. That was probably one of the toughest scenes that I had to do for the whole damn thing because it was like, you know, a three-hander being directed by Tom Hanks. And for some reason... just having Tom be the director, I had the jitters probably more than I any other scene I did, and I think that's the only scene that I remember we actually had to go back and reshoot bits of. And I'm pretty certain that it was because there were parts of it where I was just stiff and wasn't really making it sing.
The scene as aired is very different in various ways than what I remember having, what I have in the script or the audition.
Well, we rewrote a lot of it on the day. I can't remember if all the new stuff came the first time we shot it or if some of the new stuff came the second time we shot it, but it's two very different scenes. And I think something that I know that about those audition sides that you had, I'm glad to know that you actually had the script because my sense from that scene is that if you don't really know what the show is about, and I don't know how you could, having not had the scripts for the first four episodes, I don't really know how you would have known, like, what to do.
I knew what the function of the character was. I knew that prior to the episode that Winters was with his men, and I knew that Zelinsky was basically just there as to sort of visualize his new status and his new, like, the comfort level.
Yeah, I think in that scene that we had, we're just kind of spouting a bunch of exposition. And in the scene as shot, it became a lot more about sort of the personal relationship between Nixon and Winters.
It's kind of surreal to hear how much Ron has thought about what I went through on Band of Brothers. I was a person he never met. He never knew that I was hired or fired, never even knew that I existed. But now, he has spent a fair amount of time thinking about me. He even has his own theory about what happened in the casting process, and it was one I hadn't heard before.
I don't actually believe you were fired. That's what they told you. I think you were mistakenly informed that you had been hired by people who had no authority whatsoever to make that call.
Oh.
I think the casting people cast you in that part thinking, oh, yeah, he's got a couple of lines. We've got the juice to pick the person. Tom's not here yet. He's off doing his thing. And when he gets here, he'll sign off on our people. That character never should have been cast before he got into town. He should have been the one to cast that character. Like, it's got to be a sight gag that you look at this guy and you go, oh, we've seen a lot of soldiers in this show, and nobody looks like this guy. This guy looks like, you know, Radar from MASH. What the hell's he doing? And that's the sight gag that tells us that that's our thing.
This theory is erasure. This theory erases me from history in a way. I'm not sure that I like the way that this is going.
All right. All right.
I'm this close to being someone who snuck onto the lot, you know? I auditioned so many times. You can't take that away from me.
No. Okay. I'll give you that. You got paid for it.
I did get paid for it.
You booked it.
I think you're right, though. I think I know what you mean, and I do think, as I process it, I think you're right. I had the illusion of it. Technically, I had it, but I never really had it.
That audition was not for Tom Hanks to see if you could play the part. That audition was for the casting director who told you that you were going to be playing the part. That was to make him somewhat save face and not look like a total stooge when they and just call you and say, oh, actually, we made a mistake. Tom's casting this role himself. Again, I don't know this for a fact. That's what feels to me like probably went down.
I mean, they made the mistake, but I was the mistake.
They made the mistake. You were the mistake. The dead eyes thing, I think that's just they're trying to blame their mistake on you.
Well, all right. Well,
it still hurts, though, doesn't it? It still hurts. I could tell after all these years.
You know, it doesn't, but then every now and then it does.
Yeah. No, yours is terrible. I had one, I had one early on when I still lived in Chicago. It was the first pilot I ever tested for, but it was devastating. And I remember being back at home at my parents' house when it premiered. And my parents were like making popcorn and so excited, like it was an event that they were going to watch the show that like Ronnie almost got. Like it was a huge win. And I just kind of had to go upstairs to my bedroom and like sob into the pillow as I as I heard the, you know, the lines that I knew by heart.
Oh.
And frankly, I think I was better. But still, that's not as bad as what happened to you. You know, because it's just a part that I didn't get.
Every now and then, since my Band of Brothers experience, something will happen that makes me feel like I have regained a little piece of what I lost back then. I often won't even realize it's happened until after the fact. In the case of Ron, it actually happened a few years ago. You and I are on a TV show together. Did you know this?
Yeah, there was something. I know we were on the same show. Did we cross over? Were we on the same episode?
I don't know if we were on the same episode, but I'm a recurring character on Search Party.
Oh, yes. The family, right?
Yeah. I'm Ted.
Fantastic.
And it didn't occur to me until season one had already finished airing that I was like, well, that checks off another box, which is I didn't work with you directly, but I'm on a TV show, and it's a good TV show. Between that and talking to you, I feel like the Ron Livingston box is fully checked, you know?
Connor, we're going to check it. We're not going to leave until that box is checked.
Ron and I were getting along so well that it's reasonable to assume we would have also clicked back in the year 2000. Obviously, the circumstances are a little different now. We're not in some canteen north of London waiting to get called back to set. But it got me thinking about a scenario that might have been even worse for me. What if I had filmed with Ron on that first day of shooting and then been fired before the reshoots?
If you had been allowed on the set for the first day, you made it back for the second day.
Not if I was so wrong for it. It might have been one of those things.
That wasn't the problem with the first day, though. The problem with the first day was, like, pretty much squarely on me. And they couldn't fire me because I'd already done 4 episodes. So I got a pass on that.
When we return, we're going to get another perspective on what happened when they filmed the private Zelensky scene from one of the only other people who would know.
Ron thought that you had to reshoot the scene because he did a bad job that day.
He did a bad job? Highly unlikely.
Don't go away. Dead Eyes will be right back.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
You know, Fisher, I've been watching you. Showboat, always talking. Like everything you do. Big show, no results.
Every time I revisit Wes Anderson's 1998 film Rushmore, I know that 2 memories are going to come flooding back to me. One is the first time I saw it on the big screen at a movie theater called the Ritzy Cinema in the Brixton area of London. One of the few times when I specifically remember thinking, I am going to see this movie multiple times in the theater. And the second thing that pops into my head is the realization I would have a few years later that I almost shared a scene with the actor who played Max Fisher's Scottish bully, Magnus Buchan.
I always wanted to be in one of your fucking plays.
I know you did, mate.
Stephen McColl is the second of the 3 actors I almost worked with 20 years ago. And I honestly was a little nervous to reach out to him. I was worried that he would think this podcast was stupid, that I was some pathetic American actor making a big deal out of nothing. But as it turns out, Stephen was just as willing to be open and vulnerable in conversation as Ron had been.
I have to say, your podcast really touched my heart.
It did. And Stephen had his own Band of Brothers baggage he wanted to unpack.
It did touch my heart because I had a bit of a horrible time on Band of Brothers.
Really?
I'm very unique in that sense, you know, because everyone is like, it's changed their life, you know. But for me, I couldn't wait to get on with something else.
Why was that?
Well, I'm very similar to you. I almost lost the job 2 weeks before doing it.
Wow.
When I first auditioned for Band of Brothers, my accent was shit hot, if I do say so myself. It was it was very convincing. And then I got the job and I was like, great, when did I start? And I wasn't, and like you, it was episode 5. So it was months until I was asked to go on. And by then, fucking accent was gone, man. I wasn't practicing it every day. I was told I was going to get these meetings with voice coaches and stuff, and it never really materialised. So, and the character I played, I do believe Moose Heiliger was Boston, which is a very particular American accent. So up until about 2 weeks before I was due to start, they said, yeah, come up and meet the voice coach. And I went in, and within 5 minutes, she was like, yeah, you're just going to just do this general American. I just don't have time to teach it to you. And I was like, oh, fuck, right, okay. And I was waiting around, and one of the runners came in and was like, hey, Stephen, this is your first day. And I went, no, I actually don't start for another couple of weeks. I just came down to do some voice work. And, do you want to go down to set? Do you want to go down and see? It's great. There's tanks. There's 50 cows. There's all this shit going on. These guys running about. And I was like, yes, I fucking do want to do that because that sounds amazing. So he takes me down and I've got them shirts untucked and stuff, and I'm looking around, there's all these guys lying down, everyone's covered in mud, it's like a proper game of soldiers, you know, it's like fucking awesome, there's tanks coming over the brow of a hill, I'm in absolute heaven, I cannot believe I have landed this fucking gig, right?
And how old are you at this point?
22. I'd like to say 22, 23 years old, still really, really super young and still had a massive kind of chip on my shoulder, which comes into play in the next part of the story. So I'm standing talking to this guy and I hear this American shout, "Who's that fucking piece of shit? Is that the new guy? Bring him over here," right? And I'm turning around looking, going, "Whoa, whoever he's talking to is in fucking trouble." And I'm looking around and the guy, the runner's like, "Yeah, he's talking to you." And I was like, "What? He's talking to me? What the fuck have I done?" So I go over and there's this guy, and I'll never forget his name, Sergeant Farnsworth, this Marine. And I'm strolling on over, you know, I'm like fucking cocksure, getting a big gig, kind of happy actor. And I've got my hands in my pockets, and he starts drilling me down straight away. "You fucking look at your shirt and look at your fucking trousers and take your fucking hands out of your pockets." Now, Connor, where I come from, we don't let anybody talk to us like that, you know?
Yeah.
Not in the fucking street, not in the workplace, nowhere, you know? That's how I was brought up. So I'm like, "Who the fuck are you talking to?" And he's like, and he can't believe that I have answered them back like this, you know? And he's like, "Fucking, you're out of here. You're fucking gone. You're dropping. Give me 50. And I was like, I couldn't even do that if I wanted to, never mind being ordered to give you 50. So, and I put my hands back in my pockets and he lost his fucking mind. So the two of us, we're kind of like nose to nose. And I'm like, "I'm a fucking actor, not a fucking soldier. Fuck off." So we had this big fight and he said, that's it, you're out, you're gone, you're done, you're off the job, fuck off, get this guy out of my sight." And I was just, everyone all just kind of stopped and stared at us. And I was like, "You know what, mate, you're just a fucking piece of shit," and just walked away from him. And I went, "Fuck it, that's it, I've lost the job, it's gone, it's done."
Yeah.
I fucking can't believe it. Everybody, the whole cast that are there and the fields are firing, the 50 cals are all like looking over their shoulder going, "Who the fuck just got fired?" So in my heart's pounding, I'm going, "That's it, I can't believe I've just fucking blown that.
Ah, I can't believe that I got fired and you didn't." I couldn't have been more of a sweetheart. I couldn't have been nicer. You called a higher ranking officer a piece of shit and walked off.
But here's the thing. So I'm walking away and Dale Dye, the legendary Dale Dye, who was really kind of running the show.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Comes up to me in a wetsuit, right? Dale Dye's like fucking 6'6" or something, right? He's a very imposing big man, you know? So he comes up to me in this wetsuit and there's a fair whiff of whiskey on his breath, you know, so he's obviously keeping himself warm for whatever diving he's been doing in the wetsuit. And I'm going, "Who's this guy?" And he says, "Take a walk with me, son." And he takes me a walk over the brow of a hill into a field and it's just me and him. And I was like, "This guy's going to fucking murder me. I'm going to get buried underneath one of these fucking tanks. I've crossed a line that should not be crossed." And he says, "Come here, son." And he goes over and he's going, who are you?" And I says, "I'm Stephen McCall." And he goes, "No, son, who are you?" I says, "I'm Stephen McCall. I'm an actor for Scotland." He's, no, son. "When you're on this job, you speak with an American accent. You speak it. If I ask you your name, you tell me your name in this project, your rank, your serial, all that shit, right?" And I'm like, okay. And so he gives me the dressing down, but he's really kind of understanding. He says, "I know you're one of the guys that didn't do boot camp, so you don't know how to behave here. So I'm going to lay it out for you right now. This is your one chance. Listen to what I say. Do it from now on. Because if you think Tom Hanks or Steven Spielberg run this show, you're seriously fucking mistaken. I run this show. So listen up. What's your name?" I says, "I'm First Lieutenant Moose Heiliger." And he says, "Right." He says, "See that guy that was talking to you there? Who was he?" I says, "He's Sergeant Farnsworth." "So what does that tell you?" "I outrank him." "Yes, you do. So next time he talks to you like that, you tell him to drop and give you 50. And I was like, "I fucking love this job." And from that moment on, I was in, you know, I was on it.
That is a surreal story. Like, that sounds like something out of a dream. like a stress dream.
Yeah, I've told that story so many times, and every time I tell it, I'm thinking, am I embellishing this? And I'm not. I think I'm leaving shit out, you know?
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Do you remember the first time that you actually met Tom Hanks?
Yes. And I kept trying to kind of grab moments with him as he would pass me by. You know, you only think about yourself sometimes when you're doing, especially big jobs. You don't see all the moving parts. You don't realise all the shit that he's having to deal with. So worrying about my accent was the least of his fucking worries. So I'd keep trying to grab him, go, how's the accent? He'd just go, yeah, fine kid. And he'd just walk away and do other more important shit, you know? But when I first went down to do my ADR session for Band of Brothers, months after it was done, I was dubbed. It was an American actor had dubbed all my lines.
But then that didn't happen, though. That's your voice in the show.
And that is my voice in
yeah,
Band of Brothers.
Okay.
I think it is. Imagine Band of Brothers coming out and they dubbed me. I would not be sitting here talking to you now. I would no longer be an actor. I would have thrown it all away. I would have just thought, no, never again.
I would have taken it.
I think we've established that you would take a lot more than I will, Connor.
Yeah. Or even if they'd said, you can do the scene, but we're gonna digitally replace your eyes with someone else's eyes, I would have accepted that. I would have been like, that's fine.
See, that's more acceptable than the voice. But your eyes are not dead. I mean, I don't know. It's hard to see over Skype because I'm looking at you now, but your eyes don't look dead. I mean, they're alive and vibrant. You've got lovely blue eyes. What were they talking about?
That's the big question, right?
I just love that all these years later, it still annoys you. I think that's fucking brilliant. Because I carry stuff with me for eternity. I'm going to be annoyed about shit that happened when I was five, when I die.
So my assumption is you were worried about your accent that day when you were filming that scene. My assumption is you had no idea that Adam Sims had replaced another actor.
No idea.
Yeah.
No idea. I was just lucky. I was just considering myself lucky every day that I wasn't fired. I was so paranoid about my accent. That was the thing that took all the other worries away for a lot of it, you know, was just panicking that everybody that saw it was going to see straight through me and go, like, what the fuck is that Scottish guy doing playing of one this hero, you know? But the thing about being one of the Band of Brothers is there was a Band of Brothers and then there was everybody else, right? Now, I'm not saying that people were being excluded or anything like that, but these guys were living it. They were doing it every fucking day. But when I came in, because what Moose does is takes over from Damian Lewis's character, from Winters. He takes his place. And in the script, quite rightly so, all the actors, the Band of Brothers, don't take to him. They don't want anything to do with him. They think he's a dick. Well, that was my experience as an actor on that job.
Mm-hmm.
I was getting ghosted left, right and centre. I was getting treated like shit. I mean, not just on screen, but where we were kind of sitting around waiting, having cups of tea, anything like that. People were just riding me, treating me like shit. I thought, fuck these guys. I fucking cannot stand this job. I want it to end. I just hated being treated like that. I felt like I was really getting bullied.
Wow.
Not just from them, but then other actors who were playing other parts would see that happening. And that was, you know, it shows a weakness on their part that they wanted to join in. And I just thought, fuck that. So when I left Band of Brothers, it had left a slightly bitter taste in my mouth for that. And I couldn't wait to go and start on another job. So I never even thought about it again, right? It was a big, successful thing. It was great to be in it. Brilliant. Once the money ran out, I'd forgotten all about it. I went on to other jobs. Years later, I was asked to go on the Band of Brothers reunion, right? And I was like, no. For years, I said no to doing it. And I was like, no fucking way, man. I couldn't. I would feel like an interloper. You know, I'm not one of the Band of Brothers. So why would I go on that thing?
Yeah.
And I kept getting asked to do it. So eventually, I said, fuck it, I'll go. I'll go and do this thing. It's a free, you know, week in Normandy. It's going to be beautiful weather. I'm going to fuck it, I'll just go, you know. And it was almost like what you're doing with this podcast. That was that was me facing my demons, because that kind of haunted me, stuck with me. You know, why were these people treating me like shit? Because it's not a usual thing. So we get picked up from the airport with a lovely Liverpudlian actor, Philip Barrentelli, who I hope I pronounced his name right there, who's now a director, a writer-director as well. And he's a lovely guy. And he was with his granddad and chatting away to him, you know, and he was like, so, and they were all sharing their experiences and what it was like to be on, you know, now they revisit this all the time, you know, and his granddad was asking me and I was like, nah, and I laid it out how I felt and what was going on, you know, and I just felt, you know, and Philip went, yeah, we were told to do that to you. Did nobody tell you that? And I went, whoa, what do you mean you were told? And he says, no, that we were all taken aside and going, nobody talk to this guy, treat him like shit, because that's, I want him to feel that, and I want yous to, you know, feel that, but I want him to feel that he's not part of the group. But nobody fucking told me. It was like an acting exercise to get some sort of performance. I found that out fucking almost 20 years later. And I've been carrying all this baggage thinking all these guys were fucking arseholes, you know? I couldn't believe it when they told me that. I could not believe it. And I met all the guys at the reunion and they were all lovely. I still felt like an interloper. I felt like I didn't really quite belong. You know, it wasn't really my thing to be sitting signing autographs, but... yeah, that was such a weird thing. And when I heard your podcast, it resonated with me so much, because a lot of the other guys, I thought, why are these guys doing it? Why are they treating me like that? And to find that out 20 years later is bonkers.
You know, in a weird way, this probably sounds crazy, but that gives me hope that maybe this whole thing is just a very long pre-planned exercise. Maybe it was something that they were going to do. They were going to try something and it didn't work out, or they just forgot about it.
You know, it could be. This could be, I mean, I know I've heard of long form improvisation, but this is taking the fucking piss, you know?
That kind of thing, you know, if they tell you about it, it kind of defeats the purpose of it, because then you're just doing this weird off camera acting exercise.
Yeah.
So part of it is actually trying to affect you. You need to learn what it feels like to be a soldier, to be in the mud, to be exhausted, to push through it. That's something you need to learn. Nobody needs to learn how to feel like shit. We all know how to feel like shit.
I mean, I'm not totally adverse to the odd mind game, but fucking tell them at the end. That was what bothered me. Just why did they should all have went, ah, you know, you should have had that big moment where everyone went, ah, we do like you.
Yeah, there should have been a cake.
Tom Hanks jumping out the middle of it going, ah.
See, it would have been great.
It was all part of the master plan. I think you maybe saved my job on Band of Brothers, actually.
Really?
Because I think that they probably were going to fire me, and then they realised they maybe took Tom aside and went, look, how many is that you've fired and replaced? Maybe I was just at the tipping scale where they went, fuck, we'll just have to keep him. Maybe that's what happened. Maybe that's why I was still on the job. Who knows?
Well, my dad, I remember him saying it almost immediately when the episode aired, the whole point of that character is to look smaller than the soldiers that we've seen in combat. And that may have been the whole ballgame for me, that they cast someone who wasn't enough of a visual contrast. What do you think about that theory?
Yeah. Why not? It's got to be something, isn't it? It's not that you weren't good, because you were already cast, so you were already deemed good enough. So it's not about your ability as an actor. So it has to come down to some other thing. So it's physicality, it's dead eyes, it's whatever it is, but it's got nothing to do with you or your ability at that time as an actor, because let's face it, anybody could have played Zelensky. It wasn't, not anybody, not like Joe Bloggs off the street, but any actor, half-decent actor, could have done that part, done it well, and took the check and walked away, right? So you got the part. Loads of people were auditioned, and you got it. You were the best out of all the people that auditioned for it at that time. But then putting all the ingredients together for that scene, you just went, right, you were just taken out of it. I think it is as simple as that. However, you can't really do a comedy podcast about that, can you? I wasn't tall enough. It's not as interesting.
If they had told me you're too tall, it wouldn't have bothered me. And I guarantee you I wouldn't be doing a podcast called Too Tall.
Sounds quite cool to be too tall for Band of Brothers. That's, yeah.
Yeah, that sounds really impressive. It also would be mystifying because I'm just average height. And like, too tall for Band of Brothers? Jesus Christ.
How short are all the actors? 5'2". All of them. Every one of them.
Yeah.
It was a mistake.
Yeah, the cameras are all very low. They're all standing on Apple boxes.
But yeah, I think your dad nailed that when he saw it. That's exactly what I would have thought. If I had have known you then, I would have said exactly the same thing to you.
Yeah.
Yeah, you see, if you'd have played Zelensky, we would have hung out and we'd have had a good crack and I would have remembered you.
And if there was a mind game going on where we're supposed to do that, I think I would have let you know. Well, I wish I'd known you then.
I wish I'd known you then as well.
Now that I had made contact with 2/3 of the actors I was supposed to do a scene with in Band of Brothers, I realized something. If I wanted to, I was very close to being able to recreate the scene I never got to do. I mean, why not, right? I have the actors. Why not do it and see what happens? Remember that thing that Jeff Goldblum says in Jurassic Park? Your scientists were so preoccupied with whether or not they could, they didn't stop to think if they should. Well, in this case, I thought, you know, what is the harm? I could do this. And this isn't a dinosaur theme park. We can figure out the should part later. So I asked Ron and Steven if they would read their lines with me in the role of Private Zelensky. And they were happy to do it. But there was still a big hole to fill. The main character, Captain Dick Winters, played by Damian Lewis. Now, we have tried a number of ways to make contact with Damien, but unfortunately, so far we have not been successful, which meant we were going to need an understudy, someone else to play that part. And it occurred to me, why should I be the only one getting a second chance? I decided to ask another actor who had been rejected by Band of Brothers to step into the role.
And you don't have to do this, but I thought it might be fun.
Yeah, I'll do it if you can't get one. It's fan fiction.
Seth Rogen, who auditioned but never got a call back, was kind enough to take Damian Lewis's place in the scene. Just a brief technical note. All of this was recorded separately in bits and pieces under less than ideal circumstances. We're all under quarantine, thousands of miles apart, alone.
I have to admit, I'm suddenly a little bit nervous because I'm realizing that, like, it's not like I've been working on this scene for 20 years. Like, I don't know that I've made much progress beyond where I was.
I haven't, you know what, I haven't done it in 20 years either. I feel like I have a lot to live up to.
I read through the scene with Ron and then with Steven.
I've got it in front of me, yeah, ready to go.
And for my line readings as Zelensky, we have selected the best available takes from those two versions.
Mate, it's your show. If you can't do Zelensky in your own fucking show, give it up, man.
Seth recorded his lines all by himself. Just to set the scene for you, it takes place in what appears to be the large attic of a rustic European house that has been turned into a makeshift officer's quarters for the Allied forces. Nixon and Moose enter to see Winters behind a desk. During this scene, Nixon asks Zelensky who he is, orders a coffee, black no sugar, and a bacon sandwich. Zelensky leaves and comes back. Looks like he quietly sets something down on the table next to Nixon. It might be the coffee, we can't quite see. There is no indication that he has brought back a bacon sandwich yet. Then he sets some more documents on Winter's desk and leaves again without saying another word. We do not see him return. We did what we could, under difficult conditions, to create a new version of this scene that is not intended to improve upon or even be compared to the original.
You know what? We'll give it the old college try and we'll see how we do. Let's see if I got the right sides here.
I'm not trying to prove any kind of artistic point here, and I want to be clear about this. The definitive version of this scene is the one in the series featuring Adam Sims as Private Zelensky, directed by Tom Hanks, which I encourage you to seek out and watch. This is just an exercise, an experiment, an alternate take.
All right, here we go. Hey, finished your novel yet? That's a lot of homework.
And I thought executive officers was supposed to be a fun job.
Who are you?
Zelensky, sir.
Who's he?
Zelensky's my orderly.
Well, rank does have its privileges.
Orderly, huh? I suppose you do stuff like get coffee?
Can do, sir.
Black, no sugar. And a bacon sandwich. Wait a minute, you want something? Bacon sandwich?
Can you give that to Colonel Sink? My compliments.
All that for 2 pages, huh? I guess that means that's gonna take a while.
Yeah, it is. You want a job?
There it is. I think somebody wishes you were back in charge of Easy Company, Moose.
Are you two just here to gloat?
Nah, just rubbing in a little bit. Moose is going to lead his first mission as company commander.
Operation Pegasus is set to go off. I thought I might give you a heads up.
Pegasus. Yeah. Yeah, great. Everyone know their job?
We drilled with the boats all day. Lieutenant Welsh is coming along, and the Canadian engineers. Colonel Dolby knows his stuff.
Know how many times you want to cross the river?
If there really are 140 Brits in hiding over there, 3 trips.
Speed is the key. What time's jump off?
We'll be at the far side of the Rhine at 0100.
Speed is the key. Keep moving and lead the way.
Dick, Easy's in good hands.
Yeah. Yeah, right. Well, hang tough.
Could say the same to you.
Good luck, Moose.
Captain.
Nix?
Yeah.
Are we sure in the intelligence on this?
Well, I think it's pretty good.
Is Easy walking into another company of Germans no one can see?
Why don't we ask Moose when he gets back?
Right, yeah. If they do run into any trouble, will you let me know?
Yeah. You run into any bacon sandwich, do the same, all right?
Yeah.
You want to take another crack at it, or are you good with that?
Tell you what, man, that's fucking better than I did it 25 years ago.
There you go. It's like riding a bike.
You really didn't have a lot to do in that scene.
He's not wrong. Listening back to that, one of the most striking aspects is how minor the role of Private Zelensky really is. Take away the visuals and the part gets even smaller. Which begs the question, why am I limiting myself to what existed in the broadcast version? Why not explore the character just a little bit more? Let's follow Zelensky when he leaves the room after being told to go get a coffee and a bacon sandwich. What might that be like? No sugar.
Hey, can I get a bacon sandwich, please?
Bacon sandwich?
Yeah, actually, he might have asked for 2 bacon sandwiches. I'm not sure. Or maybe he might have been joking.
Whoa, hey, what happened to your eyes?
What? Oh, nothing.
They look terrible.
Okay, you know what? Go ahead and make it 2 bacon sandwiches.
2 bacon sandwiches coming right up.
I'll be right back. I'm going to get him the coffee first.
What?
I was saying I'm going to get him the coffee first. I was just thinking out loud.
Okay, well, do it somewhere else. We got a line here.
Sorry.
I will admit that creating a bonus scene of Private Zelensky Band of Brothers fanfiction is an indulgence, yes, but fundamentally a harmless one, and I do not regret doing it. My thanks to David Krumholtz for playing the role of the Army cook, yet another rejected Band of Brothers actor playing a character who did not exist in the actual HBO miniseries. On some level, maybe this is all about control. As an actor, you are rarely in control of your own circumstances, unless you generate your own work, which comes with its own set of difficulties. You're usually relying on other people to say, yes, you can play this role. You are what we are looking for. You get to be a part of this thing we are doing. Now, why did I do all this? What was the point? Well, part of it is, I finally got my chance to hang out with Ron and Steven, the way we might have done when we all broke for lunch. And we got to do a scene together. But I also got something more. These conversations were better than anything we would have said to each other back then. It wasn't just chit-chat. We got to talk honestly about what we were actually feeling, because none of us are nervous about being in Band of Brothers anymore. This was a big deal for me. These were the real guys. I mean, not the real guys. but these were the guys who pretended to be those guys for the miniseries. I almost got to pretend with them too on HBO. Now we made it happen on my little podcast. Meanwhile, the investigation continues. I have more people I want to talk to and more questions I need to ask. If you followed me this far, I want to thank you for being patient with me. I don't know how long this will take or if I will ever find the answers I'm looking for, but I'm going to keep trying. Not just for me, but for anyone out there who's listening. For all of you. For Ron, Stephen, and Seth. And also now maybe David Krumholtz. Because I know you're out there, listening. And I don't want to let you down. Dead Eyes is a production of HeadGum Studios. It was created by me, Connor Ratliff. It's written by me, and it's mostly me that you hear talking, including now. The show is produced and edited by Harry Nelson and Mike Comite. Special thanks to my guests, Ron Livingston, Stephen McColl, Seth Rogen, and David Krumholtz. If you like Dead Eyes, please do all the things that podcasts tell you to do. Subscribe, rate, review, follow us on Twitter at Dead Eyes Podcast, and talk about us nicely on social media. If you want to reach out, our email address is deadeyespodcast@gmail.com. Please tell your friends about this show. Especially if you are friends with Tom Hanks, who has a new World War II movie coming out, Greyhound. He stars in it, and he also wrote the screenplay, an adaptation of C.S. Forster's 1955 novel, The Good Shepherd. It was supposed to come out in theaters, but due to the COVID-19 pandemic, it is instead making its premiere as an Apple TV Plus original movie, which means I'm going to have to sign up for yet another streaming service for at least a month. I'm going to do it, happily. And you can tell him I said that. Thanks for listening. Stay safe. Wear a mask. Sir, have they gone?
Yeah.
Huh. Oh, well, I have the two bacon sandwiches. I'm so sorry. I guess I didn't bring them fast enough.
Speed is the key.
To be honest, I wasn't 100% sure if he was joking or not. I feel foolish now, but I wanted to err on the side of his order being on the level. Should I just leave them here for you, or I could take them if you don't want them?
Yeah.
Okay. So I'll leave them, and I'll check back later on the two bacon sandwiches. I'll just be out here if you need anything. Oh, boy. This war is something else, isn't it, sir? World War II. World War II. It sounds weird when you say it out loud like that, doesn't it, sir? I'm sorry. I'll just go. I'll go. I'm sorry. Stupid.
That was a HeadGum Original.